Chapter 33. Mental illumination with it. For the first time, as he sat there, it had crossed his mind that Viviette might have reasons for this separation which he knew not of. There might be family reasons, mysterious blood necessities which are said to rule members of old moldy mansion families, and are unknown to other classes of society, and they may have been just now brought before her by her brother Louis on the condition that they were religiously concealed. The idea that some family skeleton, like those he had read of in memoirs, had been unearthed by Louis, and held before her terrified understanding as a matter which rendered Swithin's departure, and the neutralization of the marriage, no less indispensable to them than it was an advantage to himself, seemed a very plausible one to Swithin just now. Viviette might have taken Louis into her confidence at last, for the sake of his brotherly advice. Swithin knew that of her own heart she would never wish to get rid of him, but coerced by Louis, might she not have grown to entertain views of its expediency? Events made such a supposition on St. Cleeve's part as natural as it was inaccurate, and, conjoined with his own excitement at the thought of seeing a new heaven overhead, influenced him to write but the briefest and most hurried final note to her, in which he fully obeyed her sensitive request that he would omit all reference to his plans. These at the last moment had been modified to fall in with the winter expedition formerly mentioned, to observe the transit of Venus at a remote southern station. The business being done, and himself fairly plunged into the preliminaries of an important scientific pilgrimage, Swithin acquired that lightness of heart which most young men feel in forsaking old love for new adventure, no matter how charming may be the girl they leave behind them. Moreover, in the present case, the man was endowed with that schoolboy temperament which does not see, or at least, consider with much curiosity, the effect of a given scheme upon others than himself. The bearing upon Lady Constantine of what was an undoubted predicament for any woman was forgotten in his feeling that as he had done a very handsome and noble thing for him, and that he was therefore bound in honor to make the most of it. His going had resulted in anything but lightness of heart for her. Her sad fancy could, indeed, indulge in dreams of her yellow-haired laddie without that formerly besetting fear that those dreams would prompt her to actions likely to distract and weigh him. She was wretched on her own account, relieved on his. She no longer stood in the way of his advancement, and that was enough. For herself she could live in retirement, visit the wood, the old camp, the column, and, like Enon, think of the life they had led there, mournful Enon, wandering forlorn of Paris, once her playmate on the hills, apostrophe, leaving it entirely to his goodness, whether he would come and claim her in the future, or desert her forever. She was diverted for a time from these sad performances by a letter which reached her from Bishop Helmsdale. To see his handwriting again on an envelope, after thinking so anxiously of making a father confessor of him, started her out of her equanimity. She speedily regained it, however, when she read his note. The Palace, Melchester, July 30, 18. My dear Lady Constantine, I am shocked and grieved that, in the strange dispensation of things here below, my offer of marriage should have reached you almost simultaneously with the intelligence that your widowhood had been of several months less duration than you and I, and the world, had supposed. I can quite understand that, viewed from any side, the news must have shaken and disturbed you, and your unequivocal refusal to entertain any thought of a new alliance at such a moment was, of course, intelligible, natural, and praiseworthy. At present I will say no more beyond expressing a hope that you will accept my assurances that I was quite ignorant of the news at the hour of writing, and a sincere desire that in due time, and as soon as you have recovered your equanimity, I may be allowed to renew my proposal. I am, my dear Lady Constantine, yours ever sincerely, C. Melchester. Apostrophe, she laid the letter aside, and thought no more about it, beyond a momentary meditation on the errors into which people fall in reasoning from actions to motives. Louis, who was now again with her, became in due course acquainted with the contents of the letter, and was satisfied with the promising position in which matters seemingly stood all round. Lady Constantine went her mournful ways as he had planned to do, her chief resort being the familiar column, where she experienced the unutterable melancholy of seeing two carpenters dismantle the dome of its felt covering, detach its ribs, and clear away the enclosure at the top till everything stood as it had stood before Swithin had been known to the place. The equatorial had already been packed in a box, to be in readiness, if he should send for it from abroad. The cabin, too, was in course of demolition, such having been his directions, acquiesced in by her, before he started. Yet she could not bear the idea that these structures, so German to the events of their romance, should be removed, as if removed forever. Going to the men, she bade them store up the materials intact, that they might be re-erected if desired. As he had the junctions of the timbers marked with figures, the boards numbered, and the different sets of screws tied up in independent papers for identification. She did not hear the remarks of the workmen, when as he had gone, to the effect that the young man would as soon think of buying a halter for himself as come back and spy at the moon from Rings Hill Spear, after seeing the glories of other nations, and the gold and jewels that were found there, or she might have been more unhappy than she was. On returning from one of these walks to the column, a curious circumstance occurred. It was evening, and she was coming as usual down through the sighing plantation, choosing her way between the ramparts of the camp towards the outlet giving upon the field, when suddenly in a dusky vista among the fir trunks she saw, or thought she saw, a golden-haired, toddling child. The child moved a step or two, and vanished behind a tree. Lady Constantine, fearing it had lost its way, went quickly to the spot, searched, and called aloud. But no child could she perceive or hear anywhere around. She returned to where as he had stood when first beholding it, and looked in the same direction, but nothing reappeared. The only object at all resembling a little boy or girl was the upper tuft of a bunch of fern, which had prematurely yellowed to about the color of a fair child's hair, and waved occasionally in the breeze. This, however, did not sufficiently explain the phenomenon, and she returned to make inquiries of the man whom as he had left at work, removing the last traces of Swithin's cabin. But he had gone with her departure and the approach of night. Feeling an indescribable dread, she retraced her steps, and hastened homeward doubting, yet half believing, what as he had seemed to see, and wondering if her imagination had played her some trick. The tranquil mournfulness of her night of solitude terminated in the most unexpected manner. The morning after the above-mentioned incident, Lady Constantine, after meditating a while, arose with a strange personal conviction that bore curiously on the aforesaid hallucination. She realized a condition of things that as he had never anticipated, and for a moment the discovery of her state so overwhelmed her that she thought she must die outright. In her terror she said as he had sown the wind to reap the whirlwind. Then the instinct of self-preservation flamed up in her like a fire. Her altruism in subjecting her self-love to benevolence, and letting Swithin go away from her, was demolished by the new necessity, as if it had been a gossamer web. There was no resisting or evading the spontaneous plan of action which matured in her mind in 5 minutes. Where was Swithin? How could he be got at instantly? That was her ruling thought. She searched about the room for his last short note, hoping, yet doubting, that its contents were more explicit on his intended movements than the few meager syllables which alone she could call to mind. She could not find the letter in her room, and came downstairs to Louis as pale as a ghost. He looked up at her, and with some concern said, "What's the matter?" I am searching everywhere for a letter, a note from Mr. St. Cleeve, just a few words telling me when the Occidental sails, that I think he goes in. Why do you want that unimportant document? Apostrophe, apostrophe, it is of the utmost importance that I should know whether he has actually sailed or not. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said she in agonized tones. Where can that letter be? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Louis knew where that letter was, for having seen it on her desk he had, without reading it, torn it up, and thrown it into the waste paper basket, thinking the less that remained to remind her of the young philosopher the better. I destroyed it, apostrophe, he said. Oh, Louis, why did you? Apostrophe, she cried. I am going to follow him. I think it best to do so, and I want to know if he is gone, and now the date is lost. Apostrophe, apostrophe, going to run after St. Cleeve? Absurd. Apostrophe, yes, I am. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said with vehement firmness. I must see him. I want to speak to him as soon as possible. Apostrophe, apostrophe, good Lord, Viviette. Are you mad? Apostrophe, oh, what was the date of that ship? But it cannot be helped. I start at once for Southampton. I have made up my mind to do it. He was going to his uncle's solicitors in the north first, then he was coming back to Southampton. He cannot have sailed yet. Apostrophe, I believe he has sailed, apostrophe, muttered Louis sullenly. She did not wait to argue with him, but returned upstairs, where she rang to tell Green to be ready with the pony, to drive her to Warburn Station in a quarter of an hour. Viviette's determination to hamper Swithin no longer had led her, as has been shown, to balk any weak impulse to entreat his return, by forbidding him to furnish her with his foreign address. His ready disposition, his fear that there might be other reasons behind, made him obey her only too literally. Thus, to her terror and dismay, as he had placed a gratuitous difficulty in the way of her present endeavor. She was ready before Green, and urged on that factotum so wildly, as to leave him no time, to change his corduroys and skiddy boots in which he had been gardening. He therefore turned himself into a coachman as far down as his waist, merely clapping on his proper coat, hat, and waistcoat, and wrapping a rug over his horticultural half below. In this compromise he appeared at the door, mounted, and reins in hand. Seeing how sad and determined Viviette was, Louis pitied her so far as to put nothing in the way of her starting, though he forbore to help her. He thought her conduct sentimental foolery, the outcome of mistaken pity and such a kind of gain-giving as would trouble a woman, apostrophe, and he decided that it would be better to let this mood burn itself out than to keep it smoldering by obstruction. Do you remember the date of his sailing? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she said finally, as the pony carriage turned to drive off. He sails on the 25th, that is, today. But it may not be till late in the evening. Apostrophe, apostrophe, with this she started, and reached Warburn in time for the up train. How much longer than it really is a long journey can seem to be, was fully learned by the unhappy Viviette that day. The changeful procession of country seats past which she was dragged, the names and memories of their owners, had no points of interest for her now. She reached Southampton about midday, and drove straight to the docks. On approaching the gates she was met by a crowd of people and vehicles coming out, men, women, children, porters, police, cabs, and carts. The Occidental had just sailed. The adverse intelligence came upon her with such odds after her morning's tension, that she could scarcely crawl back to the cab which had brought her. But this was not a time to succumb. As she had no luggage she dismissed the man, and, without any real consciousness of what she was doing, crept away and sat down on a pile of merchandise. After long thinking her case assumed a more hopeful complexion. Much might probably be done towards communicating with him in the time at her command. The obvious step to this end, which she should have thought of sooner, would be to go to his grandmother in Wellandbottom, and there obtain his itinerary in detail, no doubt well known to Mrs. Martin. There was no leisure for her to consider longer if she would be home again that night, and returning to the railway she waited on a seat without eating or drinking till a train was ready to take her back. By the time she again stood in Warburton, the sun rested its chin upon the meadows and enveloped the distant outline of the Rings Hill Column in his humid rays. Hiring an empty fly that chanced to be at the station, she was driven through the little town onward to Welland, which she approached about 8 o'clock. At her request, the man set her down at the entrance to the park, and when he was out of sight, instead of pursuing her way to the house, she went along the high road in the direction of Mrs. Martin's. Dusk was drawing on, and the bats were wheeling over the green basin called Welland Bottom by the time she arrived, and had any other errand instigated her call, she would have postponed it till the morrow. Nobody responded to her knock, but she could hear footsteps going hither and thither upstairs, and dull noises, as of articles moved from their places. She knocked again and again, and ultimately the door was opened by Hannah as usual. "I could make nobody hear," apostrophe said Lady Constantine, who was so weary she could scarcely stand. "I am very sorry, my lady," apostrophe said Hannah, slightly awed on beholding her visitor. "But we was a putting poor Mr. Swithin's room to rights, now that he is, as a woman may say, dead and buried to us. So we didn't hear your ladyship. I'll call Mrs. Martin at once. She is up in the room that used to be his workroom." Apostrophe, apostrophe, here Hannah's voice implied moist eyes, and Lady Constantine's instantly overflowed. "No, I'll go up to her," apostrophe said Viviette, and almost in advance of Hannah she passed up the shrunken ash stairs. The ebbing light was not enough to reveal to Mrs. Martin's aged gaze the personality of her visitor, till Hannah explained. "I'll get a light, my lady," apostrophe said she. "No, I would rather not. What are you doing, Mrs. Martin?" Apostrophe, "Well, the poor misguided boy is gone, and he's gone for good to me. I am a woman of over 80 years, my Lady Constantine. My junketing days are over, and whether 'tis feasting, or whether 'tis sorrowing in the land will soon be nothing to me. But his life may..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.